Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time and taking your calls. If you'd like to be on the program, you just need to have a telephone and a question or a comment. If you have some issue that you'd like to maybe present an alternate viewpoint upon, something alternate to what the host has said on the air about some subject, or you can just call if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, and I'll be glad to talk to you. The number to call is 1-800-227-52. I'm sorry, that is wrong. That's my morning number. This is afternoon, isn't it? I just want to make this little disclaimer. I am in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm teaching here for a week. And the time difference is such that I do a morning program every day, but here the morning program is in the afternoon. And this is evening now for us on the East Coast. So I got really confused today in the morning as to whether I was in the morning show or the afternoon show because it was afternoon here. Anyway, that's the problem with crossing time zones and trying to keep a live program going. I just was giving you the wrong number because we have different numbers to reach me at the morning show or the afternoon show. Right now, you can reach me at 1-800-438-5090. That's what it is. I know that by heart, but I was reading the wrong number off the screen. 1-800-438-5090. Well, now maybe I can get back on track. Let's talk to Stephen from Seattle, Washington, first of all. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question on a verse in Revelation chapter 16, verse 2, where it's talking about, the first went and poured out his bowl upon the earth, and a foul and loathsome sore came upon the men who had the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. And
yeah.
I'm wondering, it sounds like only the people that take the mark of the beast are going to get this sore. And I did a little research on the side effects of people that have that implantable chip put in them, and it says that they get about 10% of the time tumors fast spreading. And I'm wondering if you see any correlation there.
Well, I don't. I'm sure that some people do. But asking my opinion, I would just say I don't see any correlation. I don't think the chip has anything to do with the mark of the beast. I do believe that giving such a chip is a bad idea, and I wouldn't wish to take one. But I don't think it has anything to do with the mark of the beast in Revelation. Because the mark of the beast, as near as I can tell, is not a chip. It's a tattoo or it's a brand on the skin. Of course, now I don't know how much you know about my views of Revelation, but I don't believe that Revelation is written in literal terms. I believe Revelation is written as a symbolic drama. And I don't believe that it's talking mostly about the end of the world. I think it's mostly talking about things that happened, as the book itself says, shortly after the time it was written. The book several times tells its readers that the things are going to happen shortly or soon. And since the readers were living in the first century, I believe that most of the things in the book happened in that time frame. So I don't make a connection between a computer chip and that passage, partly because they didn't have computer chips back then, and partly because even if they did, I consider that the mark of the beast it's an image of servanthood. Namely, that in biblical times, in New Testament times, runaway slaves, when they were captured again, were branded on their hand and their forehead with their master's name or his brand, like cattle are branded, so that you know who they belong to. And I think that in using that imagery of putting the beast's brand on someone's head or forehead, head or hand, I believe it's saying that they bear the mark, figuratively speaking, of being servants or slaves of the beast. And if you go to the next verse in Revelation, in chapter 14, verse 1, that is after it's been talking about the mark of the beast, in chapter 13, in 14:1, it talks about people having the Father's name on their foreheads. So in my opinion, Revelation envisages everybody as either being a servant of the devil or a servant of God. And those who are servants of God are represented as if they have God's name on their forehead, just like slaves in the Roman Empire would have their master's name or number or brand on his forehead. And that those who are not servants of God are servants of Satan, and they're the ones who have the mark of the beast, which is figurative, I think.
when it talks about go and pour out the bowls, the seven bowls, do you think that is future or has already happened?
Well, I'm not 100% sure about the bowls, but my impression is that they are talking about things that have already occurred. Of course, I don't believe they are literal, because the book of Revelation is written in symbols throughout. And so, for example, the very description of Christ in the opening chapter is not the way I would expect him to look if we see him. After all, the disciples saw him after he rose from the dead. He didn't have eyes like fire and hair like snow and a face that glowed like the sun and feet like bronze and five, seven stars in his hand and so forth. That's all of those are symbolic. In fact, the book itself tells us what the symbols mean. The seven stars are, you know, the seven angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. Obviously, angels aren't stars and churches aren't lampstands, but this is symbolic imagery, which is then explained for us. And I think that's true throughout the book. And so, we are very unfamiliar, I suppose, with this style of literature in the West. In modern times, most of our authors don't write this way. But in biblical times, certainly in the New Testament times, lots of people wrote using apocalyptic imagery, and the book of Revelation is a sample of this style of literature. There's some samples of it in the Old Testament, too. Of course, the book of Daniel and Zechariah and even Ezekiel has some of this kind of imagery in it. But, if people don't recognize the symbolic imagery, then they would, of course, have to assume that these things never have happened. You've never seen 100-pound hailstones fall from the sky, and that happens in chapter 16 of Revelation 2. You've never seen all the waters turn bitter.
Isn't there a verse that talks about, though, that he's got hailstones prepared for the end times?
Well, in the book of Job, there's a reference to God's storehouse of the hail. It doesn't say it's stored up for the end times. I imagine some prophecy teachers, when they find that, they apply that to the end times. Say, oh, God's storing up hail. What's he storing up for? It must be for the tribulation periods, you know. But, Job mentions God's storehouses for the hail, but he doesn't mention anything about the end times in that connection, I don't think.
Because I know that there was one war, it said that more people were killed with hailstones than the army killed in a battle.
Right, that was in on Joshua's long day, yeah. Right, so, there definitely have been wars where God fought against his enemies with hail. Not very commonly,
so
but there
were
more than one time. What's that?
It could be literal then, couldn't it? Those hailstones?
Oh, there could be literal hail, sure, there could be. But see, the point is, I think the hail and many of the other plagues in the book of Revelation are echoes of the Exodus and the plagues of Exodus. There was a plague of hail. There was a plague of darkness. There was a plague of water turning to blood. There was a plague of frogs. There was a plague of locusts. You find all those in the book of Revelation, too. And in my opinion, of course, and when I say in my opinion, what I'm saying is people are entitled to have another, if they wish. But in my opinion, the Revelation is using these images from the Exodus in order to say that the judgment that came upon Egypt is now coming upon the enemy in the book of Revelation, which is called Babylon. And so the question is, who is Babylon? Many scholars think Babylon is Rome. Some think it's Jerusalem. In either case, the judgment upon Jerusalem or the judgment on Rome is being depicted in terms that are reminiscent of the judgment on Egypt, not because the judgment came in the same form. See, in Egypt, they really did have literal hailstones, as you pointed out, and so also in the long day of Joshua in the battle there. But the echo of these images from the Old Testament in Revelation are not necessarily expected to be taken as literal. For example, in Zechariah, there are two men who are said to be the two olive trees in Zechariah chapter 4, Joshua and Zerubbabel. Well, the two witnesses in Revelation 11 are also, they're said to be the two olive trees, obviously borrowing an image from Zechariah 4. But they are not Joshua and Zerubbabel. In other words, you've got the same imagery, but not the same referent, not the same persons referred to. So what Revelation does is it takes hundreds, literally hundreds of images from the Old Testament. Some chapters have 10 or 12, allusions to the Old Testament in a single chapter. And it rebirths those images in another setting in order to call to mind principles from the first time those images appeared, but now they're applied in a new situation. This is actually a fairly complex consideration, and I don't necessarily have the time to go over it in the detail I would need to, but the short answer is, while most people probably on Christian radio would be identifying the plagues of Revelation as belonging to a short period of time at the end of the age called the tribulation, my opinion is that it's not talking about that.
Okay, Steve, thank you very much for the help.
Okay, Stephen, thanks for your call. Good talking to you. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Amanda from Pacific Grove, California. Amanda, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. Well, I want to ask you this question because I don't have a good answer for any non-believers I meet. Because Jesus came into the world at a specific time and place. And, time and place, and in history. So what happens to the people before that that don't know about Jesus? And Jesus only came to Israel. What about, like, say, the Chinese and other people who are even living at his time? So I usually say to them that God has mercy. I believe that God will be merciful to those that tries to honor God, but I feel like I don't have a good answer.
Well, I think your answer is a pretty good one, actually. I believe that God will be merciful as he can be, which is pretty merciful. You know, when you think about it, God is not less merciful than we are. He's full of mercy, the Bible says, full of compassion. We aren't. I mean, we have some compassion. We have a full range of emotions and so forth. But most of us, at least many of us, we couldn't say as he can that he's full of compassion, full of tender mercies. That's actually the way God described himself frequently in the scriptures in the Old Testament. That's the Old Testament where we usually think of him as grumpy. And then, of course, we have Jesus exhibiting how full of mercy and compassion God is when he came in the New Testament. Now, what we do know, therefore, is that God is extremely merciful, more merciful than we could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that I, who am less merciful than God, would definitely not, blame somebody for something that was, not their fault. That is, if I was requiring them to know something that they had no access to that knowledge because of an accident of geography, or they were born at the wrong time in history to have any access to that knowledge, I would have to judge them on some other basis than that they know those things. Now, some people think, well, that's you, that's not God. Well, of course, that's me, that's not God. But that does seem, anything less than that would be unmerciful. To say, for me to say to you, listen, if I were God, for me to say, listen, Amanda, I want to see you run a 3-minute mile. And if you can't do that, you're going to hell, because I'm only going to let people go to heaven who can run a 3-minute mile. But, of course, that's not possible for you to do. God hasn't given you the ability to do that, hasn't given you the opportunity to do that. It's not your fault if you can't do that. For God then to punish you because you had no opportunity or power to do the thing that he was expecting, that doesn't make him seem like the kind of God the Bible describes, who is both just and compassionate and merciful. So if somebody has absolutely no way of knowing certain information, then in my opinion, it's not going to be the knowing of that specific information that God will judge them by. But he can still judge them. He can still judge them by similar criteria. For example, maybe a person's never heard the name of Jesus, just like the Old Testament characters had not heard the name of Jesus, but many of them were saved. But God has revealed himself in some way to them, if it's only through nature or through their conscience, or as in the Old Testament times, through prophets or whatever. Whatever thing God has given them, they are responsible for. We're responsible to respond to whatever God has given us in the way of light. And it seems to me, although some would see it differently, that God will have to judge people based on how much light they have. You know, Jesus said, to whom much is given, from them mm-hmm. much will be required. So we who've heard the gospel have been given the most light of all, mm-hmm. and therefore are very, very responsible for our responses. People who have not mm-hmm. heard the gospel so clearly, but the light they've received is much less clear, it's possible mm-hmm. God will judge them on a less exacting basis, but still he's going to have this, he's looking for the same thing in them.
Mm-hmm.
See, what God's looking for in a person is faith and humility. God gives grace to the humble, the Bible says,
mm-hmm.
and grace comes through faith. But even Christians don't all have equal information content in their faith. You and I both believe in Jesus, but we may not both have the same amount of information about Jesus. You might know a lot more about him than I do, or I might know more than you do, but the point is we both believe in him. Despite the difference in information, what God sees in us is the same thing, and that is a submission to him, a desire to follow him, a desire to know his truth, to respond openly, humbly, obediently to the light. And it may be that you or I have more light than somebody else has who actually is another Christian. But we all have the same salvation. And so what if somebody's shortage of light goes so far as to say they've never heard of Jesus because they live in a part of the country or of the world where no one has ever spoken of him before? Well, then God's going to have to judge them on how they respond to whatever light they have, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, God doesn't have to do it my way or doesn't have to listen to me, but my contemplation of the scriptures makes me think that that's how it is.
Okay. Yes. And there is a parable, I think, I don't remember where, but it's, I think, is it Jesus who said, God is the owner of a vineyard and sent a lot
messengers.
Of workers?
Yeah. Oh, okay. some come in the morning and some in the afternoon and some late in the day?
No, not that one. It's like a farm or something that had tenants in it. And then those tenants were not taking care of the farm.
Okay,
and then
you're thinking of Matthew 21. You're thinking of Matthew 21 at the end of that chapter. Yeah, there's a parable of the tenants.
Okay.
In the previous chapter, there's a similar parable of the vineyard. But go ahead.
Okay. But then, God sent a lot of workers to warn them. And then they wouldn't listen to him. And finally, God sent his son. And then they killed the son. So I feel like if they send the workers may be the previous prophets. And if they responded, those people who responded to the prophets, even though they didn't know about Jesus because Jesus hasn't been sent, if they responded to the prophets, they would have been saved, right?
Oh, yes. I'm sure of it. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Great. Well, thank you so much. That's comforting. And I like that answer. Thank you.
Okay, Amanda. But that doesn't mean that people don't need to hear about Jesus.
Someone
might say, well, what if people don't hear about Jesus and God judges them, therefore, on their response to what light they have and they go mm-hmm. to heaven? Then if that's true, then we don't have to go tell them about Jesus because they can go to heaven without that. And that response, that might make sense if going to mm-hmm. heaven was all that it was about. You know, if just making sure they got to heaven was all that the preaching the gospel was for, then perhaps one could argue that way, though I think there'd be fatal flaws in that argument anyway. But you see, people need to hear the gospel not because they need to get to heaven. People need to hear the gospel so that they recognize that Jesus is their king and they serve him, which is what he deserves. That's what we're preaching the gospel for his sake, you see, because he is currently being robbed of the life and the service and the love of billions of people who might otherwise serve him if they knew about him. And so we need to tell them.
Okay. I think I understand what you're saying. You're saying that we still need to spread the gospel because then they can turn their lives to Jesus and serve him because he
That's
is the
right.
king. And being a Christian, one doesn't become a Christian to serve oneself, but to serve the king.
You got it. You got my point exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Steve.
Okay, Amanda. God bless you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We have a line open if you'd like to reach us at 1-800-438-5098. 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Patricia from Santa Cruz, thanks for waiting so long. It's good to have you with us.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm reading the book A.W. Tozer, The Pursuit of God, and I came across a paragraph that just totally confused me. I'm just going to read it to you, and I'll just take your answer offline. I don't understand this. It says, God is a person, and in the depth of his mighty nature, he thinks, wills, enjoys, feels, loves, desires, and suffers as any other person may. I guess I've never thought of God as a person. Could you explain it, and I'll just take it offline?
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure what part of God being a person is different than what you thought before. There might be a couple of ways that you one or the other you might have thought before. Some people, when they hear that God is a person, they revolt against it because they think of a person as a human being. They think a person is one of us, human. But that's not what the word person means. The word person doesn't mean a human person. Angels are persons too, and God is person. To say that something or that someone is a person means that they are personal. They have personality, as opposed to being impersonal. See, there's a lot of people who believe in the ultimate reality in the universe is not a personal God, but an impersonal force. This is sort of a New Age idea. It goes along somewhat with Hinduism. And we're familiar with that concept from Star Wars and the Force. You know, the Force is impersonal. There's a dark side and a light side. And it's a power that you learn how to manage and manipulate for so that you become empowered. That's not a personal being. That's more like electricity or like nuclear power, or some impersonal power or force which can be tapped. But it's tapped by people who are persons because only a person has intentions. A rock is not a person, so it doesn't have any intentions. Well, I shouldn't say intentions because animals, we might say, have intentions because they intend to survive. But that's instinctive. I should say a person has free thought and plans and intentions that originate with the person and has personality, has feelings, has thoughts, has a will. Those are the things that constitute personhood as opposed to impersonal objects. And so when A.W. Tozer said that God is a person, he's trying to remind us that God is not simply, first of all, he's not an imaginary construct made up of certain concepts that we just have thought up in our head and doesn't really exist. Secondly, he's not an impersonal power. He is a person with personality. Now, if you're thinking that person means a human person, A.W. Tozer is not suggesting that for a moment. God's not one of us. God is a personal being, though. This is really one of two possibilities, it seems. Whatever is original, whatever created everything, either is personal or impersonal. Materialists believe, and atheists believe, that the ultimate reality is impersonal. There was no will that created us. There was no reason, there was no purpose in mind, just forces of nature that are impersonal, that don't think and don't feel and don't have any plans. Nature itself created everything. But Christianity teaches that everything was created on purpose by somebody who does have a plan, somebody who does think and feel and communicate. And that's what we mean by a person. A.W. Tozer is not innovating a new terminology. This is classical terminology. As a matter of fact, way back in the time of the Nicene Creed in the 4th century, a difference was made between the personhood of the Father and the personhood of the Son. Although they are considered to be one God, God, according to the Trinity doctrine, is in three persons. But when we say persons, we're not talking about human beings. And I think this is what modern people sometimes have trouble understanding when we use the word person. They think of people and people like us. So I hope that helps. Tozer is simply saying that God has personality rather than a rock or a tree or energy that doesn't have personality. He's purposeful, feeling, and you can communicate with him, and he can communicate with us. Anything you can communicate with verbally and can communicate back with you verbally would have to be personal, I would think. All right, unless it's a tape recorder. All right, well, I hope that's helpful. And since you're not on the line, I can't really interact more about it, though I'd be glad to. Let's talk to James from Las Vegas, Nevada next. And we have lines open at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. James, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Steve. I've got a question. I'd like your opinion on trying to get these in order. Like science and Christianity, how they go hand in hand. Like maybe science's contribution to furthering Christianity.
Well, science isn't really discussing the same issues in most cases that are being discussed in Christianity, but there is some overlap. Science is one of the ways that we discover things about reality. There are other ways. And some of the things about reality that we have to know cannot be discovered through science, because science is a limited discipline. It has a limited range of services it can provide for us. You see, if there's nothing except nature, well, science is all we need to discover everything, because science studies nature. Science, identifies natural laws, makes predictions on the basis of those laws about what will happen if you affect the system a certain way. And so we gain through science a very thorough knowledge, especially in modern times, an increasingly thorough knowledge of things natural, the biological world, the chemical world, the physical world, the astronomical world. Everything in nature is the legitimate province of science to discuss and to discover. But the problem is most people in the world have been convinced that there's something besides nature, and that in addition to the natural world, there is a supernatural world. And science can't really tell us anything about that, because science is about nature. It can only discover what nature does. It can't discover whether there's something beside nature. That would be like trying to discover, whether God exists using a Geiger counter. You know, a Geiger counter can tell you whether there's radioactivity present, but it can't really tell you whether there's angels in the room, or demons, or God, or spiritual things like love. You can't discern that through scientific tests. There are things besides nature beyond, that are not governed by the natural laws. And that, that doesn't make science a bad thing. It just makes it not adequate to tell the whole story. If there is nothing but the natural world, then science would be the only witness we need about anything. But there's also human behavior. There's also spirits in the universe. At least many people believe this is so. Now, when it comes to looking at the issues that are not natural, that are part of the supernatural, people have run, they've done tests on these kinds of things. I mean, there's been a lot of psychical research, and many people who've done psychical research have concluded there is an afterlife. There's immortality, but you can't really know for sure the reliability of the information you're getting when you're talking to ghosts at a seance, for example. You don't know if the ghosts are telling the truth. You don't know if they're good or bad. And so you need something better than those sources to know the nature of the spiritual realm. And Christianity teaches that God himself is concerned for us to understand much of the spiritual realm, enough to relate with him, because the spiritual realm is where he exists. And so that he has sent prophets in the Old Testament times, and then Christ more recently, 2,000 years ago, to reveal who he is and to testify to these supernatural things. Now, science can't testify about supernatural things at all. For example, even, let's speak of the resurrection of Christ or the miracles of Christ. Science can't tell us whether those happened or not. science can tell us that the laws of nature are such that men cannot walk on water because of the natural physical properties of water and gravitation and mass and things like that. Scientific laws can tell us that ordinarily people cannot walk on water as long as nature is the only thing in the picture. But science can't tell us whether there's something besides nature, something supernatural. A god, for example, who could suspend a man on top of water if he wished, or who could do other miraculous things. You see, miracles are simply interruptions in the normal course of nature. And science can identify the normal course of nature and can predict what will happen if the normal course of nature is uninterrupted. But science is in no position to decide whether or not the normal course of nature has ever been interrupted in the past or could be. That's simply outside their domain. So that's where we need revelation from God. Now, Christianity and science, Christianity is one of the religions of the world, one of the sources of revelation that claims to tell the truth. I believe it's the true one. There are other religions that claim to tell truths about the other world. I don't trust them. I don't think they have the authority to speak on it like Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has. So Christianity forms a source of knowledge about things that science can't provide any knowledge about. But that doesn't mean it's in conflict with it. I'm not aware of anything that a Christian believes that is in conflict with anything that science can tell us. Go ahead.
What I was thinking about was I don't think that science really is in conflict. I think it's God wrote the book, and science is just turning the pages for us.
Science is the book of nature. Science is the book of nature, and the Bible is the book of God. And so we can know about nature from science, and we can learn about God from the Bible. And those are not, the Bible doesn't say anything in conflict with science. I was just going to make this point, that people might say, well, wait a minute, you say the Bible doesn't say anything in conflict with science. Why is it that the majority of scientists then don't believe in God and don't think the Bible's true? Well, I didn't say that the Bible doesn't contradict scientists, but to say scientists isn't the same thing as say science. It's like saying Christianity forbids pedophilia. And people might say, well, but I know a lot of priests and clergymen who have been guilty of pedophilia. How can you say Christianity forbids it? Well, because Christianity is one thing. People who call themselves Christians are not always true to it. And people who are called scientists aren't always doing pure science either. Science that is pure is based on observations of things that happen pretty much all the time, predictably, repeatably, and so forth. Now, a scientist is a man who studies those things, but he's also a human being who has other aspects of his life, including a philosophy, including religious convictions, either toward or away from belief in God. He's a man who's got moral preferences. He's a man who wants to be faithful to his wife or doesn't, depending on the kind of man he is. You know, in other words, a scientist isn't some kind of a machine, a non-human walking around like a robot in a laboratory, always only believing everything he finds proven and nothing else. A scientist is a man or a woman, somebody who has preferences, opinions, political opinions, religious opinions. And those are not based on science. Those are just based on other things in their human life. And so what we find is that there are many scientists, probably the majority of scientists, don't believe the Bible. That might be true of the majority of plumbers, too. So what? It's not plumbing that tells you whether the Bible's true or not, and it's not science that does. A person will believe or not believe based on many factors in his own personal life. But science itself, which is based on observation and proof of things, has never proven or observed anything that contradicts what the Scripture says.
I agree with you on that, Steve. But what I'm saying is my spin on it is like Galileo. He was a Christian, but the church turned against him because of his observations.
Well, actually, people don't know that story as well as they should before they retell it. Galileo actually died a loyal Catholic. He was never excommunicated from the church, and he was never arrested by you know, the Catholic authority. There's a lot of legends, urban legends, that float around by especially those who are not friendly to Christianity, that try to put science against the church. And they make up things about Galileo and his relationship with the church. It is true, there was a conflict between Galileo and some of the churchmen of the Catholic Church of his time who thought he should be silenced because he was teaching that the geocentric universe was not the correct way of looking at things, and those particular churchmen thought that he was contradicting the Bible. But there were other churchmen, including leading ones, who encouraged him to publish his work. So the fact that he received some opposition from some leading churchmen has been morphed in the imagination of many people to, you know, the church excommunicated him, arrested him, you know, didn't let him teach. A person should actually do a little more historical study on that before they say that, because we've all heard, you know, that Galileo was, you know, condemned by the church because of his discoveries. Well, that's not entirely true. And you know, he died a faithful, believing Catholic, obviously not excommunicated.
Well, that wasn't my main statement. That was just my springboard to get to what
I understand that. I just wanted to clarify that because everyone listening thought, too, that he had been excommunicated. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, what I'm talking about is I went online. I'm looking at the Hubble telescope in the universe and how large it is and everything. But we had no concept of God's creation many years ago, even when I was younger. But now I'm getting a better look, and I think that God is behind this to be able to allow us to look at a bigger thing than we thought it was in the first place.
Well, you're right. We are getting views through the Hubble telescope that are like views no one has had before. However, it's not really telling us anything that people didn't know in ancient times. In ancient times, Job knew that the heavens were vast and immense. David knew that. In Psalm 8, he says, "When I consider the heavens, the work of your hands, the moon and the stars that you have made, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you visit him?" Ptolemy in the 3rd century A.D. said that with reference to the nearest fixed star, the Earth should be considered a microscopic point in the universe. So these are very ancient people, thousands of years ago, knew what we know. They didn't get to see it like we do because they didn't have the technology to look at it through the Hubble telescope. But actually, the idea that the universe is extremely vast has been known from earliest times by certain persons and certain cultures. And some, of course, didn't know that. There's some very ancient superstitious cultures that thought, you know, there was a dome near the Earth that contained the stars and so forth. But that was not the view of the Bible.
Oh, okay, my last straw is archaeology. It is one of the sciences that helps prove the Bible.
Well, what archaeology has done is shown that the biblical writers, when they made reference to ancient historical kingdoms and kings, they were right. Yeah, you're right. Archaeology has proven that the last king in Babylon was Belshazzar, when Herodotus, who wrote 400 years before Christ, had said it was Nabonidus. And for centuries, critics of the Bible said that the Bible was wrong, because Herodotus said the last king was Nabonidus, and the Bible said the last king was Belshazzar. But in 1853, they discovered Nabonidus' palace, and he made reference to his son Belshazzar as, you know, his co-regent and so forth. So the Bible turned out to be right. And same thing is true when the Bible is talking about the Hittites or Sargon II or lots of other characters, Tiglath-Pileser, who are characters in Assyria or other ancient lands that the skeptics didn't know about, the scholars didn't know about, and the Bible mentioned them. And then, you know, archaeologists discover, you know, their ruins or whatever in their names. So you're right in that respect, that archaeology has proven again and again that a biblical statement about some historical character, which had been criticized as not being accurate, turned out to be accurate after all. Okay, I appreciate your call, James. We've been talking a long time. I need to talk to someone else before I run out of time, but I appreciate your call. Let's talk to John from Kirkland, Washington. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you, Steve, for taking the call. I have a question on Matthew 24:36 and Mark 13:32. Well, my question is basically, if Jesus really did not know the future or the time that when he was going to come back, and I have been kind of wrestling with that two verses that I cannot really understand if he was able to really, did he really know the future? Or if he did not, then was he really a divine, fully God as a human being?
Okay, so when Jesus said, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, and in Mark he says, not even the Son, meaning himself, but my Father only, is that denying that Jesus is God? No, it's not denying that Jesus is God, but it's denying that he's the Father. Jesus and the Father are two persons. Both are God. And when Jesus was on earth as a man, he was deprived of knowledge of many things that he had, you know, he'd emptied himself. When he was born as a baby, there's lots of things he didn't know. He couldn't read. He couldn't talk. You know, he didn't know his mother's name. You know, when babies are born, they don't know those things. But they learn them. And Jesus, as a human being, had to learn things. And he also had things revealed to him. God revealed many, you know, the Father revealed many things to him, and he said so. When they said, how did this man know how to teach so well when he'd never studied? He said, well, it's not my teaching, it's the Father's. The Father in me is teaching these things. These are the Father's words. And so many times Jesus, didn't know something because the Father hadn't told him. He said, I can do nothing but what I see the Father do. So Jesus indicated that when he was on earth, he was not able to do all the things that the Father can do. And one of the things he can't do is tell what day that would be when the world will end.
Okay. Is there, like, any other scripture verses that would, like, give a notion that he did not know everything, or...
Well, yeah, I mean, when a woman touched him with the issue of blood, and he said he felt virtue go out of him, he said, who touched me? He said, I felt something go out of me. Who touched me? He was looking around to see who it was. He didn't know who it was. He was waiting to find out. Like I said, I mean, in the story of Jesus, we read many things about him that do not give the impression that he's God, even though he is. And the reason is because he lived under human limitations. I mean, think of it. When God never gets tired, the Bible says he never gets weary. But Jesus got weary and fell asleep and slept through a storm almost. Jesus got tired a lot. God cannot be tempted with evil. But Jesus was tempted by the devil in all points as we are. God can't die, but Jesus died. God is everywhere at once, but Jesus wasn't everywhere at once. He wasn't with Lazarus when he died. His sisters asked him to come, but he didn't come until after Lazarus died. And after Lazarus died, Jesus said, I'm glad I wasn't there. So Jesus wasn't there. There's places that God is that Jesus was not. There's things that God knew that Jesus didn't know. There's things that God could do that Jesus couldn't do. Jesus had human weaknesses. What may be helpful for you to consider is what it says in that noise I'm going to have to put off here. What it says in Philippians chapter 2 is that Jesus, before coming to earth, he existed in the form of God, but he did not cling to that. He didn't grasp at that. And he emptied himself and took on the form of a servant, that is a human form. And so he was in the form of God in heaven, but to become a man, he had to empty himself of apparently many of his divine privileges, including omniscience and omnipotence and omnipresence and invisibility and immortality. He had to become mortal. He had to die. And so when we say that Jesus is God, we're not saying the whole story. A lot of times Christians want to emphasize that Jesus is God because there are cults out there that try to deny that he's God. But while we do acknowledge that Jesus is God, we have to say it more fully. He is God in the flesh. He is God manifested in human nature. He is a man and God. He is what God looks like when God takes on human form. And when God takes on human form, he gives up some of the form that he possessed earlier, which are largely matters of size and magnitude. I mean, Jesus didn't give up any of his holiness when he became a man. He didn't give up any of his generosity. He didn't give up his justice. He didn't give up any of his character. He didn't give up his holiness. He was as holy as a man as he was as God. But he wasn't as big. He wasn't everywhere at once. He didn't have these what might be called characteristics of magnitude, attributes of magnitude, like omniscience and omnipotence and so forth. Those things are things he had to lay aside in order to actually be a man. You can't be a man and be everywhere at once. That makes you God, not man. So Jesus was God and man, and that's what's confused a lot of people. He's the God-man. He wasn't just God. He was the God-man. And the man part is the part that had these weaknesses.
Okay. That kind of makes sense a little bit. Anyway,
well,
thank you for...
Yeah. I how much sense it makes, I can't say. Because we may not have the frame of reference to make the sense of it that it really does make. It really makes sense to God. And God sees how this works. We don't. It's an unprecedented thing. There's no other case in history of God becoming a man. So we don't have a set of such experiences or events to study and to analyze and understand. One instance of the God who created the universe becoming a man and living in history, it's unique, and we have nothing to compare it with. And so we don't have all the data to make sense of it. Like, how could a man be God? I don't know, but I think God can work it out.
Yeah, that's true. I asked because I have been reading some books on textual critics.
Mm-hmm.
And I came across some paragraphs where it says the authors were saying, like, some passages, like, for instance, that particular Matthew 24:36, in some versions, it's included, and in some versions it's not there. Only to some part. So the critics were saying that the scholars were saying that sometimes the scribes, they took out some passages that did not go along with their doctrine, and sometimes they added, and some skeptics took out some passages, and some of them added. So I was kind of confused.
Yeah.
If there was some better explanation on that.
We need to listen to the textual critics because their field of study is trying to establish what the original text said from a bunch of divergent manuscripts.
Exactly.
To try to discover what the original said. But when I say we have to listen to them, we have to listen to them as we have to listen to anybody else, critically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking about science with a previous caller. We should listen to scientists. But we got to listen with a critical ear, knowing that when a scientist is speaking, some of what he's speaking is what he's learned through his field, and some of it is his own human prejudice interpreting the data. He can't escape it. A human being cannot stop being a human being and cannot be completely objective. It's a great it takes great effort to do so, and not everyone makes that effort. So the same is true with textual critics. A textual critic has scientific data that is very helpful, or can be very helpful, but he also has an opinion. He also has a prejudice. He also knows whether he wants to believe certain doctrines or not. And if he does, he can lean on some of the textual evidence that supports the doctrine he wants to support. And where there's manuscripts that omit it, he can discount them. And so you really have to be careful when you listen to the critics. The truth of the matter is that every principal doctrine that Christians believe to be true is in fact taught in every one of the existing manuscripts of the Bible. There are variants in passages, the way things are worded. Sometimes a verse or a line is missing from a single verse. But really, every doctrine of Scripture that evangelical Christians have always believed can be found taught in every manuscript that exists of the Bible. So don't let someone say, well, the scribes have changed it all and blah, blah, blah. The scribes, yeah, I'm sure some of the scribes in some of the manuscripts made a few comments of their own that didn't belong there. But they're not really, textual criticism is a pretty good science where they can see past those things. Have you been reading Bart Ehrman by any chance?
Yeah, I think that's how it all started, from Ehrman's books.
Yeah, Bart Ehrman is probably the most famous textual critic out there now, and he's not at all objective. He's a disillusioned evangelical who became an atheist or an agnostic. And, he really wants to disturb people's faith in the Bible. And he's a best-selling author, New York Times bestseller. So he's like the best-known textual critic, but he's not necessarily expressing anything that evangelicals have any serious problem with if they know the nature of the science. There's so many textual critics reach different conclusions than he does, not because he's not a good scholar, but because he's not any more objective than anyone else. And it turns out when you hear his prejudices, they are... He was an evangelical. He went through Moody, I think, or Wheaton, or both, and he was very naive. He was very naive. I think he must have had an attitude toward the Bible, sort of like the King James only people, who think it's a magic book and so forth. And then when he heard in Bible college that the manuscripts differ in such and such ways, it just threw him for a loop, and he abandoned his faith. However, when you read the things that made him lose his faith, the facts that he learned when he was in college, I learned them without going to college. You can get them in popular Christian books all the time. The facts were not, esoteric facts that only the scholars know. These are things that are public knowledge, the differences in some of the manuscripts. But for some reason, it made him give up his faith, where it doesn't make other people give up their faith because it doesn't need to. It does not have a negative impact on a sensible Christian faith. So my thought is that Bart Ehrman had a rather irresponsible Christian belief when he was a Christian. And I think he was maybe a little superstitious about the Bible, like some people are. So when he learned some of the facts, I mean, the facts that when he mentions in his books, the facts that made him lose his faith, they are facts that I've known since I was in high school. And I mean, they're not facts that make you lose your faith. They're facts that maybe change your view about the magical element that you may have attributed to the Bible. But let's change that view back, get back in touch with reality and see what the evidence really proves. For him, he went way overboard and became embittered. And now he's become the enemy of Christianity on purpose. Anyway, I appreciate your call, and I'm going to have to run because the music's playing. Thanks for calling today.
Hey, thank you, Steve. Thank you for your wisdom.
God bless you.
And bless you too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live Monday through Friday because we purchased the time on the radio stations. There are no paid employees in this ministry. I'm not paid. Nobody is paid. We bring it to you as a labor of love, but we do have to pay the radio stations for the time. And so the finances for that go into the tens of thousands of dollars each month. And we get all that money, if we get it at all, we get it from listeners. If you'd like to help us stay on the air in the station you're listening to, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can find that address at our website. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. By the way, I'll be in Las Vegas this Saturday again. There's information at the website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. God bless you.
This is Walked Away. I'm Jeff Klein. I've been closely watching a local news story. Apparently a resident started a church in his home. Unnoticed and quiet for years, except for the cars parked outside on Sundays, no one seemed to care. Then about 1 year ago, the church applied for a permit to do some remodeling. That's when the village inspector discovered the house was actually a church. Now the church would need to apply for a special use permit. They did, and the village denied the request, saying, "You can't just take your house and turn it into a church." There's lots of things to think about in this little scenario. Freedom of religion and the government's role in defining church are two of them. But the thing I've been thinking about most is why we define church as a building, as a place we go, instead of as a people. The truth is, where the church meets is irrelevant. Buildings are not essential for following Jesus. What does church mean to you? How do you define it? Tell us on Facebook.com/walktheway.